I help people feel accepting within themselves and within their own reality and preferences. I get to hear a lot of naughty stories and a lot of fun stories. Unfortunately, I get to hear a lot of terrible stories, but that's the shitty side of my job too. And that's my responsibility to hold that. So I also learn a lot.
Welcome to Grave Matters, a lively look at death.
All of us at Grave Matters would like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land we are recording from. We pay our respects to the Cammeraygal people and their elders past and present. We also acknowledge the traditional owners from all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander lands and other First Nations territories from which you are listening.
A warning, this episode contains sexual references, references to death and other themes related to dying. Please take care.
Nadine J. Cohen, hello.
Anthony Levin, habari.
Oh, where's that from?
That's Swahili.
Oh, very nice.
So, Lev, it's our last episode of the season.
No.
What?
Just no.
you refuse?
I refuse. This podcast equivalent of la 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 la.
Well, if you want to do 10 more episodes, let's go.
I am quite tired, but it's what a ride. I've loved it.
It's great. I want to know how you're going to cope without being locked in a tiny studio with me on the rag.
I do have an effigy of you at home in the storage cage that I've set up a little white
in the man cave
studio.
Or the storage cage?
No, different cage. Cage, not cave. Yeah, it's like a whole other show. You see you, me in the cage. It's fantastic.
And no more panicking emails, texts, WhatsApp messages, phone calls from me in the middle of the night.
I've been very content to be the yin to your yang.
Thank you.
But what will you do without my random acts of silliness?
I'm certainly going to miss you telling me via texts that you've sent me emails.
Look, I subscribe to the Flood the Zone school of communication, okay? Steve Bannon, inspired. Email, text, email, text, email, text.
Please repeat. Never be inspired by Steve Bannon
to do anything. I'm sorry. It's just because I'm a Luddite trapped in the body of a reluctant millennial. So I just feel like, is she going to see the email? Anyway.
Well, you don't see a lot of emails, so I should send you texts.
That's
when
true.
I've emailed.
This is true. So what are we talking about today?
We're going out with a bang. Well, we're going out with banging.
Oh, shall we?
For our final episode, we're looking at the intersection of two of life's biggest drivers, sex and death. While rarely discussed openly, both the approach and aftermath of death can deeply affect our sexual urges and identities, which can lead to anxiety, confusion, and even guilt. Today we're asking, how does grief affect our sex lives? How can we navigate intimacy in the face of terminal illness? And what the hell is a sexy puddle? Did you watch the abominable Sex and the City spin-off and Just Like That?
No, I didn't. I am very well versed and educated in Sex and the City, having watched pretty much all of it in its time. But no, I didn't see the spin-off, probably because I was just like, no, I'm done with that.
Yeah, no, you did a good thing.
Yeah. But quick question before we get into this, which one are you?
Oh, I just don't think I'm any of them.
Oh, come on.
Oh, you want me? Like I'm a writer. I love shoes.
Okay.
Like I'm eternally single. I'm Carrie, but I don't want to be like I'm the main character.
Yeah. Okay, that's fair. That's fair. It's an important quality.
Which one are you?
Well, clearly I'm the lawyer. I'm Miranda.
Yes.
So, yeah. Anyway, why do you bring this up?
So it was terrible. I watched the first season. I couldn't get past that. It was terrible. Even the clothes weren't enough for me to stay. But they actually did something really well, which was grief. Mm. And, you know, Mr. Big dies in the first episode, I think, and he has a heart attack on a Peloton. Sorry, Peloton. And also hashtag justice for Samantha Jones while I'm here. Anyway, grief sometimes causes people to, like, obsess about something because they're avoiding. It's an avoidance thing, I think. And they find a project or a slight that someone did to them and they obsess. And for Carrie, that was finding, I think she found, like, a card in one of Big's jacket pockets or something with, like, a woman's name on it. Mm. And she was obsessing, who's this woman, who's this woman, who's this woman? And I think it turned out that was actually the name of a dog, like a family dog. But there was that. And then there was also There's an episode where, like, she can't stop walking. Like, she's in, like, 8-inch heels. But, like, she's just walking around Manhattan. She cannot stop. And that's another kind of, like, show of the obsession and the manifestation of grief rather than just crying that we see in most television and film. But what they didn't do was talk about and show anything about the sexual, like, manifestations of grief, which we're going to talk about more in this episode. So we should get down to it.
Yeah, I'm keen to. But before we do, that does seem like a bit of a missed opportunity.
Yeah, I just thought it was very strange for a show based on sex to not go there.
Yeah.
But maybe none of the writers had lost anyone.
Maybe.
I don't know.
But we are going to go there.
We are going to go there today. So today we're speaking with internationally renowned psychosexologist and sex educator Chantel Otten. With a background in scientific research, sexual medicine, and counselling, Chantel has published several medical journal articles and was one of the first Australians to be certified by the European Federation of Sexology and the European Society of Sexual Medicine. She is also an ambassador for sex-positive brands Womanizer and Love Honey and a consultant for Bumble Australia. Chantel Otten, welcome to Grave Matters.
Thanks for having me.
So what is a psychosexologist?
I mean, it's not a psychotic sexologist. It just means that I work with the biggest sexual organ, which is the brain. So it's the psychology behind sex. I started in research. So, you know, studying the way people interact with themselves, with their bodies, with others, and how that impacted on their sexuality. And then I moved into more psychological sex therapy. So working with individuals, couples, groups sometimes, and, you know, helping them create a fun and fulfilling sex life.
Is this something that you chose or were particularly interested in, like, for a long time early in life, or is it something that you came to later?
So I studied psychology straight out of school. My bachelor's was in psychological science, and then I had no idea what I wanted to do. After that, I thought I wanted to go into therapy, but I wasn't, like, convinced with generalized therapy, and I hadn't really focused on specialties. So randomly I went into recruitment for 6 months because I thought maybe I'll do organizational psychology, which is such a joke because I have ADHD and I'm, like, the worst at organization. I'm so disorganized. As you know, you just met my assistant. She does all the organization for me. But recruitment really taught me a lot about business and about how to interact with people and also how to have challenging conversations. And from there, my mum said to me, you should read Esther Perel's book, Mating in Captivity. And I was in my very early 20s then, and I was like, wow, this book is a game changer.
Esther Perel is a Belgian psychotherapist, internationally renowned for her pioneering work on relationships, intimacy, and sexuality. Perel brings a nuanced cross-cultural lens to exploring human connection, often challenging conventional ideas about desire, fidelity, and love, and has become one of the world's most influential voices on erotic intelligence and relational dynamics.
I mean, I grew up with a fairly open family. We spoke about sexuality, we spoke about relationships, and we had quite an open door policy. So for me, it was amazing to see the different layers of relationships and sexuality. But also, I kind of looked around and I was like, I don't think any of my friends would know how to have these conversations or even understand these complexities like I do. And then I went overseas and I studied in Amsterdam and I became a sexologist.
Amazing.
But I studied science med, specializing in sexual medicine through Sydney University, and I did that via correspondence when I lived in Amsterdam, and that's where I did my internship, and I studied with the European Society of Sexual Medicine.
Mm. Fantastic. So a lot of people may say, oh, Amsterdam, yeah, you know, it's famous for the red light district and blah, it's a sexually liberated kind of society. Did that factor at all in your decision to be there, or is that just incidental?
Yeah, so my family's Dutch. I have a Dutch passport. And so to be there, there was a conscious choice. And that is because it was a lot easier for me to recognize that there was better sex education over there. And I think I felt very safe and comfortable there. And I had great family members who were able to talk about eroticism and sexuality. And plus, that was the place where you got to see, well, I got to see a lot of stories that I never would have seen these stories take place or hear these stories from people if I had stayed in Australia. You know, I think part of it was for me to feel free and alive and for me to also step into that life path. I could be whoever I wanted to be when I was there. So it wasn't necessarily about the education I got while I was there. It was actually about the life experience that I got.
So, if it's okay, let's start with some Sigmund. In 1920, the neurologist and seminal psychoanalyst Freud suggested that all human instincts fall into two major categories, the sex drive and the death drive, and that these are in fact inherent in us from the beginning. We're wondering, are these categories still useful in your practice, and do you believe that there is an inherent relationship between them?
If you had asked me this at the start of last year, I probably wouldn't have had like such a robust answer for you, but I definitely think so. This past year has taught me a lot. I've thought a lot more about death and about life, to be honest, and love. I think that if we look at Freud's ideas here, he's talking about sex, which is like the energy of life, that is about connection, that's about growth. He described it as eros, which is life drive, right? So that is encompassing your sexuality and your sex drive too, but it's also about all instincts that provide a great, fulfilling, pleasurable life as well. So creativity, love, connection, yes, eroticism as well. And then on the flip side of that, we have the death drive too, which is really interesting.
Freud labelled the death drive thanatos, looking again to the ancient Greeks as he did with Eros for the sex drive. Where Eros was the god of love, desire and fertility, thanatos was the human manifestation of death, pushing us towards risky, aggressive and destructive behaviour. It's more complex than that, but this isn't a 10-hour episode and I suddenly feel like Spanakopita.
That is something that I've thought a lot about because my mum passed away early last year, and on her deathbed, she told me, you know, I wish I had lived a lot more. I wish I had gone more places with my girlfriends. I wish I had had more fun. But I think death actually, in Freud's words, are more around repetition, around destruction, around the ultimate death. And with that comes the ego as well. And I think with my patients, I ask them, especially if they're having a tough time or if their relationship is having a tough time or if they're caught up in repetitive loops, I ask them, you know, what would you want to say on your deathbed? You don't want to live a life where you are lying there at the end and you have regrets. You know, you ultimately want to be really happy with the life that you create and that you live. And I think part of that is that sex drive and that life drive and that eros, which is that creativity, that fun, that freedom as well. But I think that we are geared more towards that death drive because we focus so much on our work, so much on our status, on achievements, on wealth, on these goals that might not be actually about living so much. They're actually about repetition and they can drain a lot of people and end up in burnout and unhappiness and depression and anxiety. So I really do think that he is touching on something here with that life drive and that sex drive about just expanding and feeling free and having a lot more fun.
I want to talk about grief. And we've often discussed on this show, you know, grief takes many forms. There's no right, there's no wrong way to grieve. It's deeply personal. Death can have a profound effect on sex and intimacy. Can you talk us through some of the ways people might respond to loss sexually?
Yeah, I mean, we're all going to experience loss at some stage, and it doesn't have to be grief of someone that we've lost via death. It can be a loss of connection, loss of a relationship, and grief brings us in contact with loss. It's a real dance between that life and death, if we think about Freud, because grief is essentially about activating that death drive, but it's also a real dance because grief is about love. Grief is about loving someone or something and losing it. And I think that for many people, when they experience grief or they experience a loss of someone around them, there's this real unknowing. How do you behave? How do you feel? Do you know what you feel? Do you know how to even access your body? I think it's different for the different genders. And I think if we're speaking about more feminine people, a lot of them kind of go into overdrive. It depends on what stage they are in their life. You know, if they've got young children or if they've got a business or they have families, there is this overwhelming exhaustion that I think a lot of them feel. And that can definitely lead to it's not sexy to feel so stressed. It's not sexy to feel so much mourning. But I think as well, if I think about masculine people, when they experience grief and they experience death, because so many men live from the neck up, they don't feel into their body, right? So they're in their head. They're constantly thinking and trying to problem solve and analyze. The way that they experience connection and pleasure is through sexuality. And so for them, a lot of them start reaching more towards eroticism instead. Now, I'm not saying that this is binary in terms of the genders, because it can flip either way. It really depends on the person. But I think that grief also intensifies that desire for closeness in people. So it depends on how that manifests and what your attachment styles are as well. But physical touch, comfort, that life drive, that surge in wanting to be close to someone, that can be all-encompassing. And I think that sexuality can be a very important part of that.
Mm. I think men are often accused of possibly living from the waist down. But I can remember that when I was going through grief, when my own mother passed, and I just wanted to express my condolences to you for losing your mother last year. We have both lost parents. Where my mother passed 10 years ago, I think it's probably one of the unsexiest times of my life. You know, I don't think I was thinking much about that. But of course, I had a partner who's now my wife, and I was very lucky that I did derive intimacy and we were still able to be intimate. But to be or to feel sexy and to maybe feel desirable and to desire, you need to be very embodied. You need to be in your body. And when you're grieving, you are in your body, or at least one hopes you are, because you're feeling these very intense emotions of loss. But it's a very different kind of embodiment, from my point of view, to the kind you feel when you feel sexy and desirable. Mm. I guess I wanted to hear your thoughts on that, because how do you go from, I'm just a puddle, to come
a
and
sexy puddle.
I'm a sexy puddle. That's right. Yeah.
You might not be feeling sexy if you're having sex. You don't have to, really. It can be like you're talking about more spontaneous sexuality where you go, yeah, I really want this. I can lean towards this and I'm searching for it. And we have to recognize that there's responsive desire, responsive sexuality as well. Some might be those nights that you're a puddle, you're lying in bed and you're like, I don't feel good. I don't want to be touched by someone. And then your partner might start kissing your neck or just holding you or being close to you. And you might get some rubbing on your arm, etc. And something awakens in you. Maybe that's the match that lights the fire. And maybe that's what starts bringing you back into your body. Maybe that's what starts helping you feel like you can. You don't necessarily have to feel hot or sexy at all. You can feel like shit and you can be not in that experience fully, but you can still be part of it, right? It doesn't have to be the type of eroticism that you had before. It's a new normal, because essentially grief is like a process of reorganizing your attachment style. And a lot of the time it triggers a lot of regression into your childhood, but also a lot of growth as well. So sexuality is a huge part of that, because the erotic and death also mingle along that grief process.
I'm going to overshare now.
Go.
I had a very different experience. My parents died within 2 years of each other in my early 20s, which is obviously a time of, for me at least, I think most people, heightened experimentation with sex. And after my father's death, who died first, I did not experience, I think, any change to do with sex. But when my mum died 2 years later, my sex drive like went into overdrive, which is what I like to call the grief horn. And the problem I had was that like I felt so guilty about it, the guilt of experiencing pleasure when someone's gone and in loss. But then also I don't believe in the afterlife. I'm not a spiritual person, but I kept thinking that like my parents could see me, and it was deeply upsetting. Is that guilt in particular something that people talk about with you?
Yeah, look, I think it's always a question when you have a parent that dies, you go, what are they, you know, what is happening if you believe in them, like looking down on you or what's happening after that, I think also that guilt side of things, of course, it's not about grief, actually, I think in that stage or sexual like longing or hunger. It's actually about feeling alive and having anxiety, that aliveness in anxiety too. It's you kind of overcompensating for a lot of repressed feelings and a lot of stuff that you're working through. You know, it's day to day, it's so different, right? You can't expect to feel a certain way and then know how you're going to feel the day after. But I think for a lot of people, hypersexuality can also unpack or be a flag for repressed wounds as well. And I think it's about, okay, you know, when you lose two parents, it's the abandonment wound can really come into play in a huge way. It's so different to losing one parent. There's a huge loss of control, and maybe eroticism is about gaining some sense of control as well. And there is fear of being alone. There's probably deprivation there in terms of your attachment. So for me, it's not surprising that you would feel that way. I think that that sounds completely valid and normal for what you were experiencing.
Mm. Nadine, I wasn't going to say anything, but after they passed, I did get on the Ouija board and give them a call. And boy, did they have some things to say about you.
Oh, God.
Just kidding. On a serious note, I'm really interested in this idea that you raised, Chantelle, about the dance and how maybe you might be reorganising your attachment in a time of intense grief. Because I guess I have a kind of theory about this, which is that there is a kind of symmetry in the mutual instability of loss and grief on the one side and love and desire on the other, because they can both be really messy. Mm. And what you're saying and you're offering our listeners is this idea that you can have unsexy intimacy and that can be beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
Something that I really resent when I'm watching films is when someone's grieving and really upset and they immediately segue into a sex scene. And I just find that so unrealistic. But I do appreciate this idea that you can just be in space with someone, that intimacy is a much broader spectrum than just straight into penetrative sex.
Yeah, I don't think it's unrealistic at all.
Yeah, well, that's interesting because it's something that really bugs me when I watch film. Yeah. But maybe that's just
You're so chaste.
Aren't I?
So
what
innocent.
A prude. But yeah, just interested in your thoughts on whether you see, in terms of that dance, whether you see that kind of the messiness playing out when you're patients or clients talk to you about their experiences of grief and loss. Do they embrace it or do they need a bit of encouragement to go there?
Oh God, it's all over the shop. Also, it depends. Like, are they neurotypical? Are they neurodiverse? What was sex like before? You know, what was their drive like before? You know, also, is there a sense of freedom? Maybe their parents were quite hard on them or quite restrictive on them or didn't embrace sexuality at all. So this might be a sense of freedom in some ways as well. So there isn't a one size fits all. Again, it can be a very succinct, graceful dance, or it can be a absolute chaos rave. You don't know what you're going to get with someone and their own grief experience. But I think all of it is about, okay, well, we're here and we're feeling this way. So what can we find acceptance in and validation in? And also, are you safe? Are you consenting? Are you, you know, looking after yourself? Or is this part of a destructive cycle as well? We don't know.
We've talked a bit before about, you know, timelines of grieving and how society sometimes puts, you know, why doesn't she just get over it for various types of loss, whether it's a loved one or a pet. Do you see people like setting those timelines or feeling like they have to adhere to these timelines in their own grief?
Yeah, all the time. It's actually super interesting because if I think about what kind of practitioner I was before my mom died, I would have not been able to give the right reflection on this. You know, I don't think any practitioner can really speak wholeheartedly about a subject until they've experienced it themselves. And I will say to you, like, most people won't understand unless they've experienced it themselves. So I don't think that there's any point ever putting a timeline on yourself for when you should get over grief, because there is no getting over grief, because you can't get over love for someone.
Yeah.
That's about the love that you have for someone.
Yeah, I heard a great quote the other day that was, grief doesn't end, it transforms.
Mm.
You grow around grief.
Yeah, It rearranges, it transforms, it's constantly there. But yeah, there's no end date, and those timelines are so unhelpful. People are so unhelpful with it. Why can't she just get over it? Because she can't.
I completely agree that it doesn't go away. You don't get over it. The other quote that came to mind for me when you were talking, Chantelle, is Iris Murdoch, who says that the bereaved and those who are not bereaved basically can't communicate with each other. And I think there is some truth in that, that if you haven't been through that intense loss, it can be really hard to understand and connect with someone who's going through it, because it can feel like in that moment it's just the most intense and real thing in the world.
When I hear people talk about grief and go, well, it's totally different, like that grief is more valid than that grief, and it doesn't actually work like that either. You know, all grief is valid. It's about how intensely you loved that person or that thing, you know. And then there's also survivor guilt, you know, when you're the person that's left behind. That's a whole other form of grief, because what if you meet someone and you move on quickly and then you get judged for that? What if you never move on again and people are telling you to get out there and find a partner? All of that is relevant. And who are we to say how someone's meant to survive? It's not our business. Let them be. For me, it's definitely something that I see a lot more people who are grieving in my practice. And I think also with my own family, my father's moved on as well, and he's experienced some terrible things thrown his way, terrible people that, you know, don't even really know him, but might have met my mum once or twice, saying the most heinous things to someone who's lost their partner of 37 years, you know? So when you experience your father crying on the phone because someone told him that he was pathetic for moving on so quickly, that's another layer of sadness that you have to navigate through as well.
Yeah, that's that timeline thing.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, life is for living, so continue living it. Just because you lose someone doesn't mean you have to stop living yourself.
We know that loss and grief can profoundly challenge our sense of self, but it can also really change and challenge our sense of sexual identity. So how can mourners whose sexual identity was maybe informed by the relationship they were in, and based on certain shared sexual likes and dislikes, how can they then reclaim that desire and intimacy as individuals after the loss of a significant other?
For some people, it'll be about safety and finding someone that they feel safe to be authentic with, to be vulnerable with. I mean, sexuality it's a place where you can't really hide vulnerability too much, unless you're in a performative state, right? You know, and that's no fun. We want to be in the pleasurable state and really be able to kind of melt into the sensory experience. So for some people, it'll be about safety. For some people, it'll be about experimentation and trying new things and trying to find maybe their significant other in other people as well, or find similarities. And then for some, you know, there might be some freedom in losing their significant other too. It really depends on where they're at in life. There might have been, if we're talking about sexuality, you know, if there has been long-term illness involved, or, you know, there was a sexual disconnect, but the partners were very loving and still together, there might be some freedom in the loss of their significant other, because then they can go and have fun and experiment where they weren't able to before.
So do people experience the same sort of guilt or anxiety with masturbation after a loss? Is that something you see in your practice?
Yeah, that's definitely something that I've heard a lot of. And I think like questions like, is my partner watching me, or is my parent watching me when I masturbate? Or what does it mean if I'm masturbating and a person that I loved who's passed away pops into my mind? And look, all of that is about vulnerability as well, and about actually feeling in your body and feeling your emotions. Whereas when you're not in an erotic state, it's a lot easier to kind of block those feelings away and suppress them too. So yeah, it can be very confusing and very muddled with the emotions that you're feeling at that time.
So we want to talk about sex and terminal illness and people navigating that space, both those with terminal illness and perhaps their partners or other sexual partners. What are some of the common challenges and the fears and the hang-ups that
can happen in a relationship when one person is living with a terminal diagnosis. How does this manifest in the relationship for both people or multiple people?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, terminal illness is, I mean, it's such a shit show, isn't it? It's terrible. You just don't know how long you're going to experience suffering or see someone experience suffering, how long you're going to be on that journey for. But I think for many people, terminal illness is a loss of identity on multiple facets. It's a loss of sense of self. It's a loss of capability. It's a loss of desirability. And you turn into being the patient and someone being the carer. And that's not a neurotic scenario for many people. And I think that navigating those role shifts and partner to caregiver and lover to nurse is such a, you know, it's such a tough way to be. I mean, it's such a pleasure to be able to care for someone that you love who is suffering and who is ill. But also I think that it can be terrible, especially because there's a lot of guilt that comes with that if you are in the caregiving role, especially if you feel guilty, if you want to have more intimacy, if you want to have sex and your partner is not able to, or if you want to touch them but you are unsure whether you're going to hurt them or not or make them feel worse, because sometimes fragility is a huge part of the picture there, especially if there's like, you know, treatments involved like chemotherapy or radiology. You know, there's nausea, there's so many kind of interplaying factors there that you have to be aware of, but you actually might not have a huge understanding of either. So you're just kind of trying to navigate learning more about the illness, but also the treatments, and then also how your partner's feeling. And then for the partner who's unwell, it's that fear of being seen as unattractive, broken, losing that sense of self that feels erotic and vibrant and alive. I mean, it's really, really tough. Alongside the fact that there is body changes, there's, you know, the medical interventions, there is weight loss, there's scars, there's amputations, there's stomas, there's devices, catheters, ports, all the things. And they can be in areas that are quite intimate as well that would block sometimes eroticism or challenge it as well. And then your body, it can become very painful. It can become very tired, very fatigued. Embodiment can become very confronting. And touch can also start becoming very medicalized, especially if you've got drips or if you've got bruises or if you've been given so many injections that you're just actually fearing someone coming close to you or touching you at the same time. And then there's that fear, will I ever experience pleasure again? Is this it? Was that the last time that it was going to feel good for me? Can I still give my partner pleasure? Is this safe? Am I safe? I think that desire remains for a lot of people, but the capacity to be sexual and erotic with someone is quite limited.
Yeah. And are there any common myths or misconceptions or maybe taboos in this space?
Yeah, there's a lot to work through. The challenge also remains in how you view sex, right? How you view sexuality. If it's about penetration and orgasm, then I think you're going to have a tough time. If you can view sex as like an embodied experience and outer course and touch and just intimacy in general and look at it as more of an umbrella term, then you're setting yourself up for, I think, a lot more success when it comes to eroticism. But, you know, if it's been a similar sexual menu for quite a long time and you're expecting it to be the same whilst going through treatment, it's going to become very difficult. So that's about rejigging what the new me and the new we is for a relationship.
Mm. It's this ultimate cruelty, isn't it? So many things at end of life and with terminal illness. We should experience pleasure at the end of life. Mm. To me, it's always been this ultimate cruelty of going out on a low rather than a high.
Mm.
And you could be single as well, right? You could be thinking, was that the last time that I was going to feel pleasure? When I was with that person that I'm not going to see now, right? That's something I see a lot in cancer patients.
Yeah, okay.
It's a real paradox, isn't it, that equally at the time when you might be experiencing a kind of bodily liberation because you want to realize those desires that are as yet unrealized and you have limited time, that your body might be failing and your capacity to do that is at possibly, you know, reaching its limit. That is cruel. Mm. But I'm also thinking about the relevance here more broadly, not just for people with terminal illness, but people living with disabilities, people with living with chronic conditions. I know my wife and I, hopefully she doesn't kill me for saying this, but she's lived with a chronic health condition for more than a decade. And one of the best things we did was take the pressure off in terms of intimacy, as you say, looking at sex and intimacy more as an umbrella term. And it just allows you to continue to maintain connection without feeling like if you don't achieve orgasm or whatever, that you are failing in your sex life.
Yeah, I mean, orgasm, it seems to be because of movies and TV shows like the ultimate goal, right? But it's not really about that. Yeah, it's about that skin on skin. It's about the closeness with someone. It's about the erotic. And I think that for a lot of people, if we can expand what your view of sexuality and eroticism actually is, you're setting yourself up for more success rather than perceived failure.
Mm-hmm. I'm not sure if you've watched or listened to, I imagine so, Dying for Sex.
No.
So it was a podcast made about an American woman. I think it was made by her best friend and her, Molly Koshan, who got a terminal breast cancer diagnosis in 2015 and decided to leave her marriage where she felt she was a very sexual person and she felt stifled in her marriage and that the spark was gone. And she was like, if I've only got this amount of time, I'm going out there. And she went forth and she wanted to explore kink. She'd always wanted to explore more fetish and kink practices. And she racked up, I think, like over like 200 sexual encounters before the illness and her death ended her, I'll say, promiscuity era. The TV show just came out with Michelle Williams as Molly. Are these things you've seen in your practice, like people leaving partners and people experimenting sexually in the face of death?
Yeah, all the time. It's very common. And it doesn't have to necessarily have like the ultimate death at the end. It can be illness that triggers that fear of death as well, or a scare or a sleep or an accident, something like that, where there was that possibility that it might not, you know, there might not be a journey afterwards. Yeah, I see that all the time. And to be honest, like life is about that dance. It's about living, right? So if that's going to make you feel alive and you're not harming too many people along the way and you're not self-sabotaging, just go have some fucking fun.
Yeah.
Enjoy your fun. Yeah.
And I think also, you know, she'd been in this marriage and she was worried about hurting the other person. But at that point, you've only got that much to go.
And the things that happen in that show, like they're compared to the life she had before, they're pretty out there. Like, you know, she has an interlude with neighbor guy, which involves penis humiliation and all sorts of other kinks and fetishes that she explores, which are seen, at least in the show, to the extent they're true to life, well outside the sphere of what she was doing before.
Yeah, I love that. I think that's something that a lot of people, I mean, they're scared of it because they don't understand. They don't have people they can talk to about it. Sex is still such a taboo topic. And I think even if you weren't dying, this topic is so off the table because, you know, it's so lonely having these kinks sometimes. It's so lonely when you live like a life that is successful and vibrant and dance from the outside, but can be probably quite shallow on the inside for a lot of people. I think to have these like little naughty segues in your life and little excitements, I mean, that is about what life is. That's the living. That's the eros. That's what Freud is talking about. That's the activation that we're looking for. I'm not saying everyone needs to go and look into
penis
humiliation or kink, but I definitely don't think that we should be yucking anyone's yum here. We don't want to dampen anyone's experience because I think it's all about having some fun.
Absolutely. Are there ways that you can recommend for couples to make space for both what we've talked about, the pleasure and the sadness, both in grief and in terminal illness? How do you work with patients in that way?
I guess you have to kind of see where they're at and what they're trying to achieve. You know, if they're trying to achieve a full erotic scenario that was very similar to their life before, then you're going to have to do a little bit of work there to come up with some realistic expectations and some good short-term goals. I think, you know, we just introduced things that were outside of their norm, you know, pleasure products, lubricants, you know, working with a great healthcare team, a multidisciplinary approach, some pelvic floor physio for some people, you know, lighter touch, even feathers, even just like a sensory kind of feeling, maybe fur or something quite soft. You know, you want an erotic environment. It's very hard to feel erotic when it's quite a stale environment. So making the space a lot warmer, you know, beautiful lighting, sheets that are going to feel good, and then focusing on the contact that you can have, the connection that you can have, and taking pressure to perform off the table and pressure to reach an end goal off the table. Just knowing, okay, I can enter this experience feeling safe, that my boundaries are not going to be violated because this is the expectation.
What's the biggest lesson you've learned talking to people at the intersection of sex and death?
Stay curious. You don't know what anyone's expectation of death, or I guess their knowledge of death actually is. So be curious about what they believe death feels like, looks like, even the journey towards it is like. Be curious about their preferences as well in terms of touch and communication. And always be curious about the partner that hasn't experienced a death, or if there is a partner, be curious about the people that they're connecting with who haven't experienced death or who are not kind of facing death, and how they feel or how they feel they can connect with that person as well, because they'll assume that they know, or they'll assume that they should know how to behave in those scenarios, or how to talk about death and sexuality as well. But again, it's really about the individualized experience. So curiosity is key.
Well, then in the spirit of curiosity, what do you love about your job?
Oh, it's so nice. I get to hear everyone's secrets and keep them. No, I mean, I get to help people feel alive. That's so true. I love my job. I had a patient today that has a kink, and she's never told anyone about this kink. And so we're working our way up to her feeling confident to tell her partner, who she loves very much, that she has this. And it's nothing that you would even blink an eye at. Even if it was crazy, it's all about acceptance from my perspective. So I help people feel accepting within themselves and within their own reality and preferences. I get to hear a lot of naughty stories and a lot of fun stories. Unfortunately, I get to hear a lot of terrible stories, but that's the shitty side of my job too. And that's my responsibility to hold that. So I also learn a lot. And I think when you're a nerd like myself, that's really important. You want to be able to go deeper and go under each layer and what's the why, or the curiosity.
And in being this kind of keeper of sexual secrets, do you think you learn things from your patients?
All the time, every day. They're my biggest teachers, yeah. I mean, I knew nothing when I started this job, nothing. I thought I knew a lot more, but I knew nothing. And I've been doing this for a long time. And I always tell my students or my new staff members, like, you can never assume that you know what someone's experience is just because you've heard of that experience before. You have to understand what they perceive, or what the story behind their experience is, what it actually means to them. It's about validating, not jumping to action, you know, just empathizing, validating, you know, seeing and hearing people. That's my job.
What would you like people to say about you at your funeral? It's a
funeral. You know, I've already been working on this since my mum died. I know what I want to be, so that I know what people want to say about me. I just want people to say she was fun to be around. She was alive. She brought a lot of joy into my life. I don't need to be the life of the party, but I do want to be the person that makes others feel safe within my presence. If I like them, if I don't like them, I don't even care. But I think that it's, for me, I just want people to remember my energy, and I want them to speak about my energy after I've passed.
And you said earlier you ask your patients what they might want to say on their deathbeds. Now it's your turn. What will you confess in your final moments?
Good God, I don't think I could say any of that in here. it'd end up in the news. There's too much stuff. No, I honestly, I can't tell you because I'm too scared that anything I would confess would end up on Daily Mail or something like that. So I'm keeping it all to myself.
Very wise.
I would just say there's some pretty naughty stuff that I could confess, but I'll wait for my deathbed.
Okay.
Excellent. Chantel, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me. This was a great chat. I really enjoyed it.
So that was Chantel Otten, a lovely lady who is not a psychotic sexologist. What are your thoughts?
Oh, well, many. But I would like to cap off our last episode of season two with a little quote.
Oh, God.
From the Stoic philosopher and Roman emperor Marcus Aurelius, or as I like to call him, Marky Mark. It's a bit deathy and it's a bit sexy, so it seems apt. Are you ready?
No.
Okay. Yesterday, a blob of semen. Tomorrow, embalming fluid and ash. That is actually a real quote from the Meditations.
Wow.
Yeah.
That is crazy.
Isn't that sweet?
Thanks, Marcus Aurelius.
So, Nadine, we've asked all our guests this question, and I'm realising now how cruel it was. But I have to put it to you, and we only have time for one, eulogy content or deathbed confession? What's it going to be?
Ooh, deathbed confession.
Good call.
Yeah, I have no secrets. I've written a lot about many very deeply personal things about my life that most people would rather die than reveal. But I was thinking about a colleague that I had almost 20 years ago, and I used to love an office prank when I worked in corporate environments. And I one day went into someone's computer and emailed myself as them asking me out as a joke.
Totally normal.
Totally normal. And then I waited a few weeks and then I responded and said no. but maybe we can be friends. And he still to this day does not know that that was my doing. So that guy, if you're listening, which I hope you're not, that was me. You're welcome.
Great prank. A great corporate prank.
Thank you.
Yeah.
And you?
Oh, gosh. Look, I'd probably tell my sister that when we were kids and she was out of the house, I would take her Barbie doll and I would make her hook up with He-Man, okay? And you may think, oh, He-Man, he's all muscly, master of the universe, you know, but actually had the sexual experience of a eunuch, right? So he had his sexual awakening with Barbie in the early 90s.
Okay? In your house.
In my house. And I'm so proud of that.
So Kirsty.
So Kirsty.
If you're listening.
You're listening. I'm sorry. It was all above board.
I don't know how it was all above board or how it would have been under board. Okay. So, Anthony.
Yes.
We're at the end of the season, the end of the road, as some would say, some being you.
Say it ain't so.
And I would like to know if you have any thoughts or feelings to just, you know, sum up the season.
It's very hard to sum up the entire season, and so I won't really attempt to. But I was thinking for a death podcast, I'm quite intrigued by the theme which popped up a couple of times, and that's this idea that maybe we can stave off death altogether. And that came up in the AI discussion. It also came up in our discussion about curing death. And if that does happen, how am I going to get the grief horn? No, I don't want to miss out on that experience. But seriously, I am ceaselessly amazed by the multitude of perspectives on this topic. Mm. And I just feel like, you know, we could go on and on. But we are at the end. So what about you? What are your final reflections?
Look, it was also great. I want to convey to our listeners that, like, the high that I get from our interviews with all these people and just talking to interesting, passionate people is such a joy. I keep thinking about Gabrielle, our forensic cleaner, when I'm cleaning my house. I want to go to the Appalachian Mountains and meet Alex and his students in Tennessee. You know, it's been such an uplifting season about death.
Yeah. Who would have thought?
Yeah. So I guess I'm just sad it's over.
Well, I can probably cheer you up. Do you need me to sing another Boys to Men song like I did last season?
Yes, yes, I do.
Okay, well, cue music.
I'll make love to you when you want me to, and I will not let go till you tell me to, and even then I won't.
Sorry, you went totally off course. And so that's a wrap on season two of Grave Matters. Thanks again to our fellow nerd Chantelle Otten and to all our guests for so generously sharing their thoughts, their expertise and their passion. And from the very bottom of our death curious hearts, we thank you for listening and joining us on this journey. If this episode has raised issues for you and you'd like to seek mental health support, you can contact Beyond Blue on 1300 224636 or visit beyondblue.org.au. Also, Embrace Multicultural Mental Health supports people from culturally and linguistically diverse backgrounds. Visit embracementalhealth.org.au. For 24/7 crisis support, call Lifeline on 13 11 14. Or in an emergency, please call 000.
Grave Matters is an SBS podcast written and hosted by me, Anthony Levin, Nadine J. Cohen, and produced by Jeremy Wilmot. The SBS team is Joel Supple, Max Gosford, Bernadette Fung Nam Nguyen, and Philip Solomon. If you'd like to get in touch, email audio@sbs.com.au. Follow and review us wherever you find this podcast.